You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
In all the time she'd been working at FCI Englewood, in the Supermax prison infirmary, she had never seen Charlie Manx with his eyes open. She'd been on staff for 3 years, and he had been comatose all that time. He was the frailest of her patients, a fragile coat of skin with bones inside. His heart monitor blipped like a metronome set to the slowest possible speed. The doc said he had as much brain activity as a can of creamed corn. No one had ever determined his age, but he looked older than Keith Richards. He even looked a little like Keith Richards, a bald Keith, with a mouthful of sharp little brown teeth. There were 3 other coma patients in the ward, what the staff called gorks. When you were around them long enough, you learned that all the gorks had their quirks. Don Henry, the man who burned his girl and her kids to death, went for walks sometimes. He didn't get up, of course, but his feet pedaled weakly under the sheets. There was a guy named Leonard Potts who'd been in a coma for 5 years and was never going to wake up. Another prisoner had jammed a screwdriver through his skull and into his brain. But sometimes he cleared his throat and would shout, "I know," as if he were a small child who wanted to answer the teacher's question. Maybe opening his eyes was Manx's quirk, and she just never caught him doing it before. "Hello, Mr. Manx," Ellen said automatically. "How are you feeling today?" She smiled a meaningless smile and hesitated, still holding the sack of body temperature blood. She didn't expect a reply, but thought it would be considerate to give him a moment to collect his non-existent thoughts. When he didn't say anything, she reached forward with one hand to slide his eyelids closed. He caught her wrist. She screamed, couldn't help it, and dropped the bag of blood. It hit the floor and exploded in a crimson gush, the hot spray drenching her feet. "Ah," she cried. "Oh, God!" It smelled like fresh-poured iron. "Here, boy, Josiah," Charlie Manx said to her, his voice grating and harsh. "There's a place for him in Christmas Land with the other children. I could give him a new life. I could give him a nice new smile. I could give him nice new teeth." In a search engine puzzle, there was always a lot of distracting visual information, a lot of noise. The first book had culminated inside an alien spaceship. Search Engine had to find his way through a cross-section of the craft, flipping various self-destruct switches as he went, and arriving finally at the escape pod. Between him and freedom there were lasers, locked doors, radiation-filled compartments, and angry extraterrestrials that looked like big cubes of coconut jelly. Adults had a harder time with it than children did, and Vic had gradually realized that this was because grown-ups were always trying to see their way through to the end, and they couldn't do it, because there was too much information. There was too much to look at, too much to think about. Children, though, didn't stand back from the puzzle and look at the whole thing. They pretended they were Search Engine, the hero of the story, down inside the puzzle itself, and they looked at only the little bit he could see, each step of the way. The difference between childhood and adulthood, Vic had come to believe, was the difference between imagination and resignation. You traded one for the other and lost your way.
Joe Hill is the author of the short story collection 20th Century Ghosts and the novel Heart-Shaped Box. With Gabriel Rodriguez, he writes the Lock and Key comic series. His last novel was Horns, and his new novel is NOS4A2. Thank you for joining me, Joe.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, the title of the story is NOS4A2, which is the bad guy's vanity license plate. And if you sound it out, it spells Nosferatu, which is the German word for vampire. And I live in the state of New Hampshire, and where one out of every 3 cars has a vanity license plate. And I've probably been in three, four car accidents, you know, leaning over the steering wheel, trying to figure out what that license plate ahead of me reads. And I sort of like, you know, the puzzle-like nature of some of these plates. And I wanted the title of the book to be a puzzle, to be something that makes the reader stop and you know, sort of scratch their head and go, what does that mean? The book is full of puzzles, and I kind of like the title as one as well.
Do you have this license plate?
No, but I'll tell you what's funny. My very first reading was at Water Street Books in Exeter, New Hampshire. That was my first reading for Nosferatu. And the night of the reading, a guy pulled up front and parked his car, and his license plate was NOS-4A2. And he had actually gone to the DMV the week before and found out that it was available and paid his $25 and got the plate stuck on his car. So, and I have seen several people on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, and several people have sent me photos of other cars that have similar license plates. So that one is out there.
Oh, that's nice to know. One of the things I think that makes this book so wonderful is the way you've written it. It's like a layer cake, and you lay on layers and you give us different plot threads. I'd like you to talk about how you conceive the book. Do you conceive it chronologically beginning to end, or do you just dive in and start laying down layers and see where each layer leads?
My approach to writing any story is I usually begin with concept, with a high concept, an exciting idea. But I do think that clever concepts are kind of like juicy fruit chewing gum. You know, if you've ever had a stick of juicy fruit, you know, for the first 15 seconds, it's the tastiest chewing gum in the history of chewing gum. But then after that first burst of sugar and flavor, it gets to be like chewing a pencil eraser. And I think that high concepts are kind of like that too. They're a big blast of sugar and pleasure, but that blast wears off fairly quickly. And then if people keep reading, they keep reading because they love the characters. And so my approach is really, you know, to begin with that concept, but then find some characters to anchor the story, some souls that the reader can root for, people with interesting emotional lives and an engaging inner landscape. And, you know, I'm not a guy who writes whodunits. My stories have always been kind of who are they? Explorations of character, their lives, their histories, their desires, their weird obsessive impulses. I try to find a couple good characters, and then I stick them into a box and see if they can punch their way out. And with Nosferatu, there were a whole series of boxes, almost like a Matryoshka doll, that, you know, there was boxes inside of boxes inside of boxes. And so when my heroes would fight their way out of one, they would find themselves in another one. And it wound up being about 700 pages of these boxes for them to struggle against.
At the heart of this book, or running through it, is a really interesting family story of the main character and her parents. And I like this family story because the people are all pretty damaged, yet they're likable. The father in particular, I thought, was a very compelling figure.
Yeah. I had written my first novel, Heart-Shaped Box, had a male protagonist, a 50-something heavy metal rocker named Judas Coyne, who buys a ghost on the internet. My second book, Horns, also a male protagonist, a young man named Ig Parrish, who wakes up one morning and finds he's growing a pair of horns. In my book of short stories, 20th Century Ghost, there's 15 stories in that book. Every single book has a male protagonist. And my whole career was starting to feel like one long sausage party. And so I decided with Nosferatu that I wanted to write a female lead. And I came up with this character, Vic McQueen, who we meet as a little girl, and we see her through her troubled adolescence and then into adulthood. And I really wanted to explore female life on a grand canvas. And then I also wanted to write about parenting. You know, the boogeyman in the closet is terrifying. The monster under the bed is scary. But being a parent is much more frightening than either of those things, because every day is a new chance to see terrible things happen to your child. There's only so much you can protect your kids from, and you try your hardest. But the world has so many ways to scar your kids. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about being a mother and what that experience is like and how scary that is. And I also wanted to write about how frustrating it can be for a woman to be defined as a mother and not have a chance to be defined as anything else, because Vic McQueen is an artist. She's a creator. She has a past before she was a mother. She's had failed relationships. She's made bad choices. She's done work of which she's very proud. So she has had a big life, a big full life, and I wanted to kind of explore all that. I hate in genre fiction, mother characters are often so depressing because all they do is bake muffins and dispense wisdom. And I really wanted to do something that was more real than that. And And to also get a chance to see, you know, that it's possible to be a mother and love your kid and sometimes not be all that happy about that role, you know, to be kind of a reluctant mother, to feel like this is, I didn't think this was what my life was going to be, but here I am and I'm going to do my best for this kid.
One of the things I think that struck me about Vic was the way that you have created her over this grand arc gives us access to her at all the these kind of breakpoints in her life.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to talk about creating those that plot arc for her. But did that arrive as you wrote the book, or did that come out of your sugar burst?
Yeah, the you know, Nosferatu is as long as my first two novels put together. And it was even longer in first draft. I think that the writer is writing for themselves, and you're really trying to discover who those characters are. And I have a tendency to spin lots of material to put my characters in situations just to find out who they are and how they react to things. But in the second draft, in the third draft, in the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, you really have to think about what the reader needs, and just mercilessly cut everything that doesn't entertain, that doesn't excite. I'm a big believer in suspense as the driver. Suspense is the thing that keeps you turning pages. Suspense is a single word that essentially stands for that feeling that makes you desperately want to know what happens next. So I wrote a lot about Vic's life. I wrote a lot about her childhood, about her teenage years. I wrote extensively about her years as a young mother. But in the finished book, we get really the greatest hits. We're really getting the highlight reel. There is 15 pages between the time that she is, that where we explore her, between the time she's a teenager and when she is a mother of a 10-year-old, because I wanted to stay focused on the story that was exciting, on the story that you know, created tension and suspense. And I felt that in terms of her being a young mother, we just needed a taste of that, because the story leaps along from one important event to another. I value the reader's time, and I think it's important that every scene be exciting to read, that every scene have something meaningful and powerful that makes you want to read the next scene. And so on that level, I'm wary of writing anything that's just character for character's sake. On the other hand, I desperately avoid anything that's just plot, because I'm not interested in just plot. I'm interested in people.
You have balancing out Vic. We have Charlie Manx,
yeah,
who's an indelible character, and we meet him at the very beginning, and you describe him in a way I think that really sets him physically in our minds, and I think that's very important for the way this novel works out.
Now, basically, the plot of NOS 482, the plot of Nosferatu, is there's a very bad man named Charles Talent Manx III who has a car that runs on human souls instead of gasoline. And Charlie has used the power of this car to keep himself young and fit for more than a century. And he does so by picking up passengers, almost always kids, and taking them for a long ride. And on the course of this ride, they are drained of something essential. And when he's done with them, there's nothing left but these little monsters that are filled with hate and teeth. And he drops them in a demented amusement park called Christmas Land. So that's Charlie, and Charlie is this frightening, larger-than-life, villainous character, and he is opposed by Vic McQueen, who has an enchanted, reality-bending ride of her own, a Triumph Bonneville motorcycle. And while Charlie uses his ride to destroy lives, Vic uses her vehicle to save them. Unsurprisingly, the two of them find themselves in opposition over a course of 25 years and thousands of miles of road. And I really think, for a book of this size, you need a big engine under the hood. And that big engine is always your antagonist, your villain. You need a bad guy who's really ready to put the pedal down to the floor. And that's Charlie Manx. Charlie was a hell of a lot of fun to write. If you asked him who the hero of this book is, Charlie would say him. That everything he has ever done has been about protecting children, saving children, rescuing them from harm and from the dangers of the world. Charlie can justify every single murder and every single terrible thing he's ever done in the name of protecting kids, protecting their innocence, protecting their happiness. He's very persuasive about that. But of course, he is the biggest monster of them all.
As you wrote this, one of the things I think you do really well is you provide what I would call plot frosting.
Plot frosting. That's a great term. I'm going to start using plot frosting at readings. That's great.
Well, what you do is this, is you give us a monster like Charlie, and you show us what he does, but you don't necessarily tell us exactly how it works. As readers, we're smart enough to figure that out, kind of. And we're happy to just see things charge along, see what happens, and figure we might not never know, ever exactly find out, because that's sometimes the nature of these books. But then you'll give us that moment of what I call plot frosting, where you'll just sit down for just a second and tell us exactly why. And it's such a satisfying part of our reading experience. I'd like you to talk about creating these moments of plot frosting through the book that really keep us glued. And as readers, it's a super satisfying experience.
Well, I moonlight as a comic book writer. I've spent about 5 years writing an ongoing comic called Lock and Key about a 250-year-old New England mansion full of impossible reality-twisting keys. I love comics. And in comics, and also in film and television, they talk about the reveal. The reveal is a shocking, unexpected twist image, a jolt. A big jolt to the nerves that almost always comes on the even-numbered pages, because the even-numbered pages is when you turn the page and suddenly something is revealed. That's why they call it the reveal. It's in show business, it's actually sometimes a bit of an overused term. But I do like the reveal when it's properly prepared for, and I think that you can do those in novels as well. Have that moment when you leap into a new chapter, and then suddenly you are confronted with something you didn't see coming, which makes perfect sense, but which hits you like a brick to the head. And I think though it can be great to keep those moments coming. They're the shock that you didn't expect to see when the roller coaster takes a sudden twist to the right or the left.
Well, I think, too, that the effect of reading a book like this that's big and has lots of characters, it is like eating a layer cake. You take a piece, and every piece of the book gives you a different little slight, a different layer of every character. And one of the things that interested me was the way you sometimes create what I would call pocket characters who show up in just one scene, but we just absolutely love them, like Bilbo.
There is a nurse in a hospital who has a number of geek tattoos who's named Bilbo, and we get him for a moment. There is a nasty old cop named Daltrey, who is pretty amusing in spite of the fact that, you know, in spite of the fact that he does a lot of damage, you know, has a lot of collateral damage over the course of the story. Daltrey is entertaining. There is a character named Maggie Lay, who is a punk rock librarian who lives in here, Iowa, in the same way that Vic has a totem, a vehicle that can bend reality. In the same way that Charlie Manx has his car, which can twist reality, Maggie Lay has a device of her own. She has a bag of Scrabble tiles, and she can reach into this bag and throw tiles on the floor and then arrange the letters to spell secrets. And I had a lot of fun writing Maggie. I think she's unexpected and strange and, you know, and makes interesting choices and says interesting things. And it, you know, so she was, I think it's important to remember that just because a character is a bit character, if they were in real life, they wouldn't think of themselves as a bit character. No one thinks of themselves as a secondary character or an extra in someone else's movie. Everyone thinks of themselves as the star of the show. And I think it's important to treat each character as if they were potentially the protagonist of their own story.
This novel turns off of something, you know, that in real life is very frightening. Disappearances, when people disappear, that in itself, it's almost a supernatural feel to it that we feel in real life, because they will just gone. And you have, when you're writing a novel like this, you have the potential for having some kind of real life echo, which point of fact, you do, where we've now seen three women who just recently disappeared. So I'd like you to talk about this kind of the natural, supernatural trope of the disappearance.
Well, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of punning in the book. There's a lot of wordplay in the book. And one concept that I play around with is the concept of the search engine. You know, Vic McQueen has written a series of children's books called Search Engine, which is about a robot who goes hunting for secrets. And Vic's Triumph Bonneville motorcycle, which can throw a kink into reality, is her search engine. She can go out on this bike and find her way to a bridge that doesn't really exist in our world. And while some bridges span rivers, this bridge spans the distance between lost and found. She can go across it and find whatever it is she needs to find, whatever, no matter, even if it's hundreds of miles away. And search is one of the big verbs of the 21st century. And when someone disappears, when a child disappears, when a young woman disappears, when we have an abduction, that's terrifying and bewildering. And it's a hole in it's a missing chunk of information, crucially important information, emotional information, and we can't. It's so unbearable, you know, for a loved one to be lost and not to have information, not to be able for the search engine to come up blank over and over again. And H.P. Lovecraft said that the greatest fear of all is the fear of the unknown. And I think not knowing what's happened to one of your loved ones, not knowing what's become of them, where they are, is one of the greatest terrors we can ever face. And this is partially the job of fiction. Fiction is a safe playground to explore fears that in real life make us very uncomfortable. You know, no one wants to think, in fiction, let me revise, in fiction, we can be quite entertained by a story of a relentless monster coming to devour us. Hannibal Lecter, you know, the idea of Hannibal Lecter capturing us and eating us is a giddy, dark thrill that we will explore in a novel. In real life, we're never going to have to face that. Most of us will never have to face being devoured by a serial killer. But some of us might have to face being devoured by cancer. You know, there are relentless, pitiless killers waiting out there for you at some point in your life, whether it's heart disease or cancer or whatever. None of us like to think about that. We don't want to think about our own demise. But in the safe playground of fiction, we can explore those notions and even have fun with them. We can prepare and we can rehearse for our own emotional reactions when we do have to face something truly upsetting or dark. And that's one of the great powers of fiction.
One of the things I think you do very well is to create antagonists who are monstrous and terrifying, but also engaging in a way. And both Charlie and Bing, and when you were talking about your punning in this book, I think it's very appropriate that the rather pathetic Bing,
yeah,
as opposed to Google in the search engine world.
there is also a character named Bing, which is a riff on a search engine, and that comes up. There's a lot of jokes layered throughout the book. Charlie Manx has run through a series of henchmen. In some ways, Nosferatu, as the title suggests, is a big reimagining of Dracula, with if Dracula was a car instead of a person. And just like Dracula has a Renfield, Charlie Manx has a character, Bing Partridge, the gas mask man, who is kind of a pathetic henchman who helps him in his abductions. Both of them at times are very funny, I think. I don't know, but I think that they're, and I think that's because humor and horror are very closely allied. They're really two sides of the same coin. When I was a little kid, I used to read Fangoria magazine. I used to love Fangoria magazine, which was a magazine dedicated to the work of the gross-out special effects artists like Tom Savini and Rob Bottin and Stan Winston. And those guys, those gross-out special effects guys, talk about gags. A gag in special effects is when the alien bursts through someone's chest or when someone takes a hatchet in the head. And I've always thought that terminology was interesting. I thought it was interesting that Tom Savini talks about performing gags. I don't think that's accidental, because the truth is, when we see Larry hit Mo in the head with a hammer, that's a gag, and we burst out laughing. When we see Charlie Manx bash someone in the head with a hammer, we scream and recoil. In both cases, we're seeing the exact same scene played for different effect, and we're having a kind of animal brain reaction to it, either humor or horror, fight or flight. And I think that, and for that reason, I think that, you know, comedy and horror are almost the same thing. It's just the lighting is different.
And both, as you say, it's an unconscious reaction. That laugh or that shiver is something you have no control over.
Yeah, it's reptile brain. You know, one of the reasons your hair stands on end when you're scared is because in primates, the hair bushes up to make you look bigger and more threatening. And of course, us humans are fairly hairless, you know, all things considered. And so when our hairs stand up, it doesn't actually do much to make us bigger, but we do have these animal reactions to things, these simple reptile brain reactions to things. And I also think that fiction is exercise for your reptile brain, because those fight and flight responses are important and are powerful. And also, fiction can sometimes teach you to overcome them. I think it says something wonderful about humanity that when the bombs went off in Boston, the video shows people running towards the blast to provide emergency services and help without thought. And I don't know, would we have always seen that reaction? I have no idea. I don't know. A part of me says, you know, the animal brain would tell you to run. But maybe over time, people have learned to overcome that animal brain response and to say, I'm going towards the trouble, not away from it, because people need my help. And I think that's very encouraging. I'd love to credit art with that response. I would love to credit, you know, books and movies and music with teaching people that. But I don't really know. I don't really know why people respond with heroism instead of cowardice so reliably.
Well, maybe this is a beneficial effect of the often maligned, you know, action-based, violence-based movies.
It may be. We often hear, you know, that, you know, someone committed an act of violence because of a video game or because of Marilyn Manson or, you know, I mean, this is a cultural argument we have been having for decades. It goes all the way back to Elvis. There was a belief that Elvis led to juvenile delinquency. Comic books, the horror comic books of the 50s, you know, were demonized by the congressional hearings on juvenile delinquency. And now I think people would look at those comics and say these were tame. These couldn't possibly have caused, you know, criminal acts. But I think, you know, I think it is possible that the right fiction, the right movies, the right songs can teach heroism. You know, if you're going to demonize video games, if you're going to say, you know, video games or comic books or movies can have this effect on people's, you know, minds and warp them and, you know, make them more aggressive and more violent. If all those things are true, then I think you also have to admit that it's possible that these things can make people more heroic, more empathic. I've always believed that art is about, ultimately, at its foundation, is teaching empathy. And I also think that horror fiction is better at teaching, when it's done well, I think horror fiction is better at teaching empathy than any other genre or art form. I believe that good horror is completely founded on empathy. You know, for that reason, it is a genre that probably deserves better than its reputation, deserves to be, you know, more appreciated than it generally is.
Well, good horror, and this is an excellent example, creates empathy. We feel empathy not just for Vic and the other characters who are protagonists, but we also, I think, understand a bit about some of the antagonists and Charlie and
Bing. Yeah,
Bing. They stir some enough comprehension in us that even though they're repugnant and they're evil, we at least kind of recognize them as human, and that's what also makes them readable about.
Yeah, they've all been badly damaged, and you know, Bing is a kind of, you know, occasionally hilariously pathetic figure, and you know, Charlie Manx, you know, Charlie, that car that Charlie Manx drives in a way has drained him just as much as it has drained, you know, the children that he's taken for rides. So, yeah, I mean, you know, look, in the 80s, there were the slasher films, you know, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. In the late 90s and early aughts, there were the what was, you know, called torture porn, you know, films like Hostel and Saw. I liked some of the slasher films from the 80s. I enjoyed those when they came out. But I think most of that stuff is really bad horror. You know, in those 80s slasher films, you get these characters, the slut, the jock, the geek, the good girl, and they're all kind of these one-dimensional stereotypes. They're just pins, candlesticks, for Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees to knock down. And in those films, a lot of times, the most fully fleshed out character is the killer. And you wind up laughing at their jokes and being entertained by their ingenious forms of slaughter. You know, and again, some of those movies I think are wonderful, but for the most part, I actually find that a fairly morally abhorrent position for an artist to take. I don't want to root for the bad guys. I want to root for the good guys. When horror succeeds because it gives you a character to love and identify with, someone who has a rich emotional life, who is then faced with the worst, who is faced with real darkness, and you're there with them. You know, you're there feeling what they're feeling and seeing them, you know, face the monsters and face the night, and you want to see them survive, and that is a deep emotional connection, a deep feeling of empathy. I think that's powerful and in its own way sort of educational emotionally, you know, that you learn things about empathy that then you could bring into the real world.
Imperfection in your protagonist is a very important aspect of that, I think, because your characters all have various imperfections.
Yeah.
It makes them more easily relatable to. It also helps them when they encounter the darkness to have something to understand what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we learn from our mistakes, you know. We make mistakes. And I think, you know, good people are often defined by their regrets, by, you know, the thing that they did, the things they've done that they desperately wish they could take back. People who don't have regrets, people who don't have guilt, those tend to be monsters. One of the things that Charlie does to his passengers when he takes them for a ride in his 1938 Rolls-Royce Wraith is he strips them of all the unhappiness in their soul, all their guilt, all their anger, all their shame. And on some levels, that sounds beautiful. I mean, isn't this almost like, you know, what New Age therapy tells us we need to lose our guilt and to lose our shame and, you know, and to be sort of, you know, innocent and pure as a child. But innocent children will rip the wings off a butterfly and laugh about it because they don't know any better. True innocence lacks empathy. We learn from our shame, our regrets, our guilt. And those feelings, painful as they are, teach us to be better and teach us to care about people. Being stripped of your guilt doesn't make you a wonderful person or an innocent person. It makes you a sociopath.
One of the things I think this book does well, too, you talk about sociopaths, is that you give us a portrait of a couple of serial killers, I think. And
yeah.
These are like real-world manifestations of your supernatural evil. And I think that works well. That bolsters that effect.
All good stories are about something bigger than themselves. They ask, you know, I feel like when we turn to nonfiction to resolve questions that have answers. And when we turn to fiction, it's because we want to explore questions that don't have answers or maybe don't have easy, simple answers or concrete answers. Like, what happens to us after we die? You know, no one really knows, so we've written a lot of stories about it. Another one is, what will it be like when I have to face the worst? What will I feel? How will I react when I'm finally faced with the possibility of my own end, especially if that end is very horrible? These are questions we need to explore, but that are hard, you know, that are difficult to think about. A lot of popular entertainment, not all, but a fair chunk of pop entertainment never is about anything except itself. I heard one big summer tentpole action figure described as a failure because it was about nothing but itself once years ago, that it was about nothing except like robots and explosions. And I understood that. I mean, I understood that criticism. Until a story asks interesting questions, it isn't anything but surface, you know, and it may be a brightly colored, exciting surface, but when you poke at it, there's nothing behind it. So you want to ask a story that's, you know, why do people turn out this way? Why do people take pleasure from destroying the lives of others? Why do they need that? Why do they feel that compulsion? You know, well, that's a hard question to answer, but fiction can help look at it.
One of the ways you look at that question in this book is through the creation of this trope you call the inscape.
Yeah.
And this is a kind of inner landscape, but it also struck me that it's also a literary device that you use in the novel to create these different inscapes of the characters just in terms of the narration. And it also struck me, too, that the novel as a whole is itself its own inscape that we as readers explore, enter one end and come out the other, not the same person.
Yeah, I think that inscapes are kind of my unified theory of everything. You know, in some ways, all three of my first three novels have all been about inscapes. This idea that basically we all live in two worlds. We have one foot in the real world, you know, the world of where we have jobs and bad hair and bad coffee and physics and gravity and sweat and all the rest of it. But most of us spend a lot of time in another world, our private worlds of thought. And in those worlds, emotion has the force of gravity. Imagination, it has its own set of powers, just like physics, its own set of laws. And the heroes and the villains of Nosferatu are people who can bring those two worlds together, who can split the seams between the world of thought and the real world. Vic McQueen can use her Triumph Bonneville to bring forth an imaginary construct called the Shortaway Bridge, which he can use to throw a kink into reality. Charlie Manx has an imaginary world of his own. He has Christmas Land, which he can use his vehicle to bring into existence. That sounds like a very fabulous idea. It sounds kind of, you know, absurd and ridiculous. In fact, I believe in it completely, and I think that artists do this all the time.
That's why you call these two people strong creatives.
Strong creatives, you know, and so you have, you know, you look at someone like Keith Richards. You know, Keith Richards hears a song in his head. Then he grabs his totemic device, his reality-bending device, his Stratocaster, and he plays that song he hears in his head and brings it into the real world. And before you know it, it's in your head and it's in my head and it's on the radio and it's out there. It's an actual thing, you know. And readers also use, you know, powerful reality-bending devices to bring the imaginary world into the real world. And those are books. So, you know, this is sort of like one element of the human condition is how to make the real world more like our private worlds of thought. And I think humanity has been struggling to do this since we started painting, you know, bison on cave walls.
One of the things, too, I like about the inscape as a literary trope is it allows you to give this entire book an almost science fictional feel to it.
Yeah.
In that things start to seem logical. At one point, you explain why Vic has a pain on a particular side of her head, and I don't want to go into exactly why that is, but I think that this inscape allows you to bring up more plot frosting that as readers, you go, oh, yeah, this all makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't mind ruining that bit for you. Every time Vix trips across her impossible bridge, damage her. All the strong creatives who use devices to bend reality pay a price for it, pay a toll, some higher than others, depending on what their ability is. Every time Vic goes across a bridge, it damages her sanity a little bit, and it also produces these blinding pains she can feel in her left eye. And the reason for that is because the creative center of your brain is in the right half of your brain. That's where your imagination, that's really the throne of your imagination, the seat of your imagination. The right half of your brain, because of a funny twist in our nerves, sees out of your left eye. And so it sort of made sense for you know, her, the use of that power to you know, kick back to create feedback that she would especially feel right behind her left eye. So, yeah, anytime you can make your nonsense sound a little more science-like, you know, it you can sell it. It's a little easier to sell it to your reader. So, yeah, I'm always kind of looking for anything I can grab and say, see, science.
Yeah, you're a master at the hand-waving, as it's called.
Yeah, well, I think that actually the guy who was best at that was the late Michael Crichton, who was sort of the master at taking some, you know, fabulous, absurd idea like, you know, bringing dinosaurs back to life and then throwing some science fictional gobbledygook at you, and you'd read it and you go, oh, yeah, no, we'll be doing this any day, you know. And of course, it was all nonsense, but it was great sounding nonsense.
You know, you talk about Christmas Land, and that comes out of all this inscape. And I think this goes on the list of fantastic places. Rivendell,
yeah.
Never Neverland, at Wonderland, the places that that our authors create for us that are fantastic places that become as real as the real world to us.
Yeah, Christmas Land has its roots in a couple other imaginary inscapes, you know, a couple other fantastic locales. One is, as a child, my favorite cartoon was Pinocchio. And there is a part of a subplot in Pinocchio where little boys are brought to an island, Pleasure Island, and they're given all the cigars to smoke, and they can gamble and swear and spit and eat bad food. But the longer they stay there, the more it destroys their humanity until suddenly they wake up one morning and they've turned into donkeys, which I thought was, you know, as a kid, I thought, oh, I get that. I understand. This is why you're not supposed to act that way, because it turns you into a mule, a jackass. And I thought that was wonderful. Also,
And creepy.
And that transformation is very creepy. And so in some ways, Christmas Land is a little bit like Pleasure Island. In some other ways, Christmas Land is a little bit like Dark and Cougar's Pandemonium Shadow Show, which is the carnival in Something Wicked This Way Comes, Ray Bradbury's groundbreaking horror novel. And I was very much thinking about those creepy rides in Dark and Cougar's Shadow Show, you know, the carousel where every time you go around, you age another year, and some of the other, you know, the Hall of Mirrors and some of the other terrors in that particular traveling show. So there's a little bit of both in Christmas Land.
You mentioned Ray Bradbury's groundbreaking novel, and you were talking earlier about 80s horror. And for me, I never particularly liked any of the slasher movies. I just found them kind of dull.
Yeah.
But 80s horror, for me, was really encapsulated by, you know, the great big books of the 80s, you know, your father's books.
Yeah.
Peter Straub, Robert R. McCammon, Clive Barker, all these great big books that, you know, were big and immersive. And I think that kind of fiction is making a comeback now, and I'm super happy about it.
Yeah, you know, there was It and The Talisman and Ghost Story. You know, there was Clive Barker's Weave World, fantasy and horror on a grand scale. I grew up with all that stuff. I love all those books, you know, and I think now we are seeing some stuff. We've seen a lot of, you know, the novels of Neil Gaiman. He's gone big a couple times, and those have been, you know, vast worlds that you can totally get lost in. You know, there was The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern just a little while ago. There was Jonathan Norrell and Mr. Strange. Was it Dr. Norrell and Mr. Strange? I think I'm blowing the title on that one. There has always been a place for dark fantasy on a grand scale. Its popularity waxes and wanes, but we're going through a period where it's waxing, and I think that's in part because the world, with every passing day, seems a little less like a real place and a little more like a place that we're all imagining as technology increasingly comes to seem like magic, and as we all become more connected and everything speeds up. You know, the crazy thing about Iron Man, which I saw a little while ago, was in the middle section of the story, you know, Tony Stark goes on a long adventure where he, you know, he fights bad guys using a bunch of stuff he jury-rigged together from supplies he got at Walmart or something. And it's totally believable. And you're looking at this and you're looking at this movie and you're saying, is Tony Stark really that unbelievable? Isn't he basically just a big cross between like Richard Branson and Bill Gates? Is there anything he's making and doing that basically Richard Branson and Bill Gates couldn't have done? I think one of the reasons we're all in love with the superhero movies right now is the world they're depicting no longer seems that fantastic or strange, but actually only about two steps away from our world.
Well, that's more scary.
Maybe that is. Maybe that is scary.
You know, one of the things I love about genre fiction and horror fiction is name-checking.
Yeah.
And you do quite a bit of it in this book. And I was really pleased. My favorite bit was when I first saw DeZoet.
Yeah, there's a David. There is a David Mitchell homage planted in a chapter in the middle of the book. David Mitchell is probably the best writer working in English today. you know, a profoundly powerful writer. He's not just the greatest writer of my generation, but he's already in the very best writers of the last century, I think, to work in English. And I loved Cloud Atlas and The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. And so I threw a shout out to his work there in Nosferatu. And there are a lot of other shout outs to various my various geek obsessions, to Firefly, and also to a degree to my dad's work.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of connections to your father's work.
Yeah, when I started out, I dropped my last name and I started writing as Joe Hill, and I worked as Joe Hill for about a decade without anyone connecting me to my dad. And in that time, I was able to sell my first book of stories, 20th Century Ghosts, and then my first novel, Heart-Shaped Box. And my pen name actually came apart before Heart-Shaped Box was published. But in the 10 years I had managed to keep myself a secret, I had been able to develop my craft and get comfortable in my own skin and get some confidence, which I desperately needed. I was a very insecure kid. Even though I've written in horror and dark fantasy, there has been a lot of avoiding overt reference to my dad, you know, steering clear from, you know, the work of Stephen King. But in Nosferatu, I really wanted this book to be like my senior thesis on horror. And I don't think I can write about horror. I don't think I can do that without exploring my dad's work to a degree. And also, maybe it's because I'm 40 and I'm just a lot more relaxed now. And I thought, instead of avoiding my dad, I'm going to have some fun with his work. I'm going to goof on Stephen King a little bit. So there are a lot of Stephen King Easter eggs tucked away in the book, which I just stuck there, like the David Mitchell references, because I thought they were funny. You know, there's a Saint Bernard and there's a malevolent car, and you know, there's a character who at one point screams to Charlie Manx, "My life for you." It's the gas mask man, and that's a joke on the trash can man from The Stand. And none of this stuff is in the book because it has any particular meaning to the world. It's just basically I have trouble going more than five pages without starting to goof off.
Well, it also is a way, yet another way, that you provide satisfaction to the reading experience. I mean, as readers, we read this, and if we're picking up Nosferatu, we're certainly picking up, we've probably right. been all those other places too, and it's more fun.
Yeah, well, that's really what you want. My, you know, people always think this is a joke, maybe a bad joke. You know, when people ask me what I'm scared of, I say what I'm scared of is people reading 30 pages and putting the book down and saying, "Boy, that looks like a lot of work," you know, and then walking off, wandering off to watch funny cat videos on YouTube and never coming back to my novel. So I don't write by outline. I don't think in terms of the grand picture. When I'm writing a story, I work scene by scene. And I want every scene to really be a new firework going off. I want every scene to feel exciting on its own terms and to keep you flying through the pages. And if a scene can't do that, it has to go. I can't afford to have one paragraph where you're scratching your head and saying, "Boy, I wonder if this is going to be boring. I wonder if I, you know." And at the same time, it can't just be one stunt scene after another, because you want to finish the story and feel satisfied, to feel that emotionally something has happened that you're glad about. So I'm just, you know, I'm totally shameless. I'll do anything to keep it fun and engaging and to keep you turning the pages. And that ranges from building suspense, you know, and trying to do that Hitchcock thing where the bomb is under the table and you're wondering when it's going to go off. So the book is full of bombs, you know, and you're waiting to see when they're going to explode. And there are big action set pieces. And there are a lot of jokes, because jokes are also satisfying.
Talk about creating the set pieces. They're so much fun to read. It seems like they must be fun to write. Do you block them out? And
I love to create an unexpected scene of action. There is a scene in Heart-Shaped Box where we have this 50-something heavy metal musician who gets into mortal combat with a middle-aged housewife, where she's breaking plates over his head and coming at him with kitchen utensils. And I had so much fun writing that scene. And the reason it was delicious, the reason I loved it, is because it's not a fight scene we've seen before. You know, we're used to seeing Mel Gibson battle some strapping homicidal maniac, you know, in a cop film or whatever. But what you're not used to seeing is an aging, shambling hairy heavy metal musician, you know, who's ready for AARP, you know, battling a middle-aged housewife, you know, with everything she can find in the kitchen, you know. And so I'm always looking for ways to take an action scene in a direction where we haven't seen this before. We haven't seen these people fighting. We haven't seen them fighting in this way. And I also, you know, and I also like to have that moment when you think, wow, I just hit the big climax. And then you turn the page and you realize actually it's just beginning.
No, there's plenty of that in this book. And I think you have entirely effectively succeeded in making every scene exciting. One of the tricks you use, I think, is really interesting. I've never seen this done before, where you'll leave off the end of a chapter in mid-sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. There are several chapters. And I've heard people say they download the ebook. And then they'll complain to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whoever. I was really enjoying this story, but there's something wrong with my Kindle edition because the chapter just ended mid-sentence. And, you know, and then I kind of have an evil snicker because chapters end mid-sentence. But then if you read on to the next chapter just picks that sentence up mid-flow. The title of the chapter will be a part of the sentence that came before, and the thing just keeps sweeping you along. Something else I stole from David Mitchell, who has done a lot of interesting things with chapter breaks and form and structure. And you know, I learned from one of the writers I loved in my 20s and still love was Bernard Malamud, who insisted that form and content were irresistibly wedded to one another and that you couldn't have one without the other. And so I think a lot about form as well as content. This is why, by the way, it's a mistake for writers to start thinking of themselves as content providers. And it's one of the challenges of ebooks. And as much as I love ebooks, it's one of the reasons why I love books in print, because I don't just want to have control over content. As an artist, I want to have control over form as well. And ebook publications, to a degree, deny me of my control over form. I don't care for that so much. And so that's one of the things that I struggle with when you're looking at e-editions is how can I warp this so that I'm still controlling form. It's one of the reasons why you hear snide technology people say, you know, everything is going to go digital, books are going to disappear just the way records did, time moves on and you have to move on with it or you'll get crushed. They can say that if they want, but a book is form as well as content. If you strip away the form, you no longer have the same work of art. So to a degree, there are things about the hardcover that are unique to the hardcover that you don't get in the ebook, and there's no way to get them because it's a fundamentally different form.
The book is a La Cucaracha of technology. They've been trying to kill that damn thing for hundreds of years. And I mean,
hasn't worked too well, has it?
No, it hasn't. And I don't think it's ever going to work so well as they think it's going to.
Yeah, no. And there are things you can do with a hardcover or a paperback that you can't do in an ebook. For example, you can write in the margins in a hardcover, and they have tried to replicate that in ebooks, and I am sorry, it is not the same. You know, and there are just the physical book is an artifact that has power of its own. When you download something, you're downloading zeros and ones, and it's ephemeral, and it can, you know, as soon as you're done with it, it's gone. It just floats away like, you know, dandelion seeds on the wind, disappears into the cloud. You have no more control over your book. You know, that book that you were reading, you finish it and it's out there in the cloud. It's gone. It's like trying to grab a cloud. And, you know, when the hardcover allows that book to remain a part of your life. And, you know, I think a hardcover has a totemic power, just like Vic McQueen's, you know, Triumph Bonneville. It's a reality-bending device, and, you know, and you abandon it at your peril.
Absolutely. Well, it certainly takes you out of one reality into another. I'd like to talk a little bit about the difference for you as a writer between working with Gabriel Rodriguez on the Lock and Key books and working with him in this book, because he illustrates this book as well. And there's a fabulous iPad moment. Totally love it.
Yeah, yeah. There is some art in the middle of the book where someone uses their, you know, a lot of people complain that Apple Maps doesn't work too well. Well, I'll tell you what, midway through the book, someone pulls up Apple Maps to try to get a handle on where Charlie Manx might be. And you know, and then you get to see some real, you know, you get to see that map program really warped. Gabriel Rodriguez has been illustrating Lock and Key and collaborating on that story with me for the last 5 years. He's one of my best friends in the world. The comic book, you know, is not my work that he illustrates. It's our story. We are co-collaborators on it. I have learned as much about those characters from the way Gabe draws them as Gabe has ever learned from me, from anything I wrote about those characters in the script. We are like an old married couple where he finishes my sentences. And I really was so happy that I was able to bring him into Nosferatu and have him do. He did some glorious end papers, which I would note are not in the ebook. And he did this naughty nice list up in the front of the book that you can use to keep track of your loved ones and figure out which list they're on, which I think is handy. You know, and I love that kind of thing. And there are illustrations in the hardcover of various powerful objects. And all that are part of the unique pleasures of fiction. I very much respond to 19th century literary values, big Dickensian books of character and incident. And in the 19th century, stories were published episodically. Oliver Twist didn't come out as one book. Oliver Twist was published over months in a series of episodes. And also, fiction was illustrated. Everyone knows what Sherlock Holmes looks like, not because of anything Arthur Conan Doyle wrote about Sherlock Holmes, but because of the way Sidney Paget illustrated him with the hawk-like nose and the pipe and the deerstalker cap. In the early 20th century, writers like Hemingway sort of somehow convinced the world that fiction didn't need to be episodic and that illustration was for little kids. And I, you know, I'm not the writer that Hemingway was. I don't have 2% of his talent or anything, but I reject those values. I, you know, I've loved working in comic books because I think that you can engage a reader on a different level when you're working episodically. You know, you read one chapter of the story and then you have to wait a month for the next chapter. And in all that time, you're writing the story yourself in your mind. The reader is enjoying, they have not abandoned the story. It's still a part of their inscape. They're still loving it. You know, I've said for years that the great power of the original Star Wars movies wasn't the movies themselves. It was the 3 years in between movies when you could write your own Star Wars stories and imagine a past for those characters and a future for them. And I also think that illustration, you know, if you look at the crossover success of the Harry Potter novels, I think you have to credit J.K. Rowling's amazing storytelling prowess and her characters and her humor and her grand scale. But I think you also have to look at Mary Grand Prix's art, which was delightful and a visual pleasure and a place for the eye to rest. You know, you're going through these huge blocks of prose and then you come to a little illustration and it gives your eye a rest and it's like a little candy. So I want those things for my stories.
You mentioned the word Dickensian, and I think that's really the closest analog to the 80s horror opus. Dickens didn't use very much supernatural, but there was occasionally some in his books. And
that's right.
And he's, you know, the all-time most popular, best-known ghost story is his.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And when you look back at the writers of the 19th century, you see a lot of people who are willing to dabble with the ghost story. Or with elements of science fiction. I look at, you know, Mark Twain and Pudd'nhead Wilson. And, you know, Mark Twain, that story was CSI, you know, set in Missouri. He used the science of fingerprinting, which had never been done before. And he wrote about it, and people read that in a story, and mind blown. You know, people like, oh, wow, you know, you can use a fingerprint to figure out who committed a crime. What an amazing thing, you know, and no one had ever done that. That was like science fiction back in the day, you know. Of course, it's science fact now. But I think that we went through this stage with some writers who felt that the only respectable mode for adult fiction was realism. And of course, I think nowadays we know that as great as those writers were, Fitzgerald, you know, Hemingway, Dreiser, you know, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. You know, there's plenty of room for escapism, for fantasy.
The world is too weird to be described by mere realism.
Yeah. And, you know, I love Hemingway. Hemingway is one of my favorite novelists. Hemingway could have learned a great deal from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You know, in Spanish cultures, magic realism is a very long tradition. The willingness to bring in glorious elements of fantasy and surrealism into a realistic story, that's something Spanish writers have never shied from. And I think, you know, and world literature, you know, English literature and English language literature and other cultures have just been catching up to what Spanish novelists knew 25, 30 years ago.
And on the other hand, I think that your fantasy-oriented novels benefit greatly from realistic, low-key characters who are not superheroes. They're just average. They're like the people who work at the 7-Eleven. I think that's one of the real appeals. And that's a Dickensian trait as well.
I agree. And I think that we're living in a wonderful, wonderful time for people who like to explore genre elements, because we have seen a lot of creators like Michael Chabon and John Lethem, who we think of as basically literary writers, but who have not been afraid to take mystery elements or fantasy elements or science fiction elements and throw those into their stories and use them to explore character in interesting new ways. And at the same time, you've seen a whole generation of writers who explore fantasy elements and horror elements, who think of themselves as genre writers, but who are using genre tropes to write character-driven fiction. And I would look at someone like Joss Whedon, who is, you know, the king of the geeks, who, you know, Avengers, Firefly, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But what people, when people love those stories, what they think about is not superpowered explosions or set pieces. They think about great character moments, you know, moments where you just completely fell in love with one of his characters. So I would look at Joss Whedon. I think David Mitchell is a really interesting figure in the sense of, you know, Cloud Atlas, Ghost Written, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob DeZoet. If you look closely at those stories, you could see a lot of genre tropes creeping around the edges. One of the novellas in Ghost Written is written from the point of view of a disembodied spirit that can jump into different bodies. And there is this great end of the world science fiction story in Ghost Written. There is a villain in the Thousand Autumns named Abbot Enomoto, who for my money is at least as terrifying as Hannibal Lecter, and who has possibly been alive for centuries by wallowing in the blood of infants. And that's a great, great, terrifying character right out of horror fiction. You know, so this is a good time for schmucks like me who, you know, who love genre elements, because we can write this fantasy and horror stuff and actually get some literary respect.
And readers like me who get to enjoy your books as
Thank
well.
Thank you. Thanks.
I've been speaking with Joe Hill. His newest book is Nosferatu, N-O-S-4-A-2. Thank you for joining me, Joe.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I had a blast.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.